We have some great programs lined up for you during Holy Week, and here's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen. It's a special church bulletin insert for Issues Etc. Holy Week programming. Just go to the support page at issuesetc.org, download, print, and make copies of the Holy Week bulletin insert. The bulletin insert can be used for the weekend of Palm Sunday, April 1st. Issuesetc.org and click support.
In some ways, their arguments make some sense, or they seem to be kind of intuitively true. We have scholars like Bart Ehrman who have written a book or two saying, look, the New Testament that we have, it's fine and good such as it is, but you got to realize it's the result of a very, very long string of transmissions where errors have crept in, where things that may have been in there in the beginning have fallen out. There were people copying errors. There's all sorts of things. So what you have in the New Testament can't really, realistically, bear any resemblance to the original New Testament. And after that, there's all sorts of problems with variations in the texts. He makes it sound like what we got at the end is just kind of a garbled version of, well, we can never really know what the original was. It's hard to tell, and even he himself speculates on the point. How reliable are the texts of the New Testament? Joining us to answer some of those questions on this Monday afternoon, March the 26th, Mark Pearson. He's a Master of Divinity. He has a Master of Divinity from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's pursuing a PhD in New Testament Studies, and he's written an article for a recent edition of Higher Things magazine titled Text Typos and Transmission, Why You Can Trust the New Testament. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Good to be with you again.
What do you make of Bart Ehrman's argument, which is essentially it's been so long and it has passed through so many hands that what we have in the New Testament can't possibly bear any resemblance to any alleged originals?
Well, I'd say that's utterly misleading, and Ehrman knows that it's misleading. Your characterization of Ehrman was pretty accurate in that that's what he says, but he usually takes away with one hand what he just tried to give you with the other. Let me give you an example. At the very end of his most popular book, Misquoting Jesus, New York Times bestseller, he goes through chapter after chapter saying why we shouldn't trust the New Testament, and then in his conclusion he says, quote, "To be sure, of all the changes found among our manuscripts, most of them are completely insignificant, immaterial, and of no real importance for anything other than showing that scribes could not spell or keep focused any better than the rest of us." End quote. So Bart Ehrman is essentially saying, the entire book I just wrote to try to scare you into not trusting the New Testament, I shouldn't have written, because in the end, when you do in fact investigate it, you find that the scribes were pretty accurate and that we can actually trust the New Testament.
Most people come into contact with this problem in an English translation. They'll come across, say, a real toughie, and this is a toughie, the story of the woman caught in adultery in John's Gospel. Mm-hmm. And they'll realize in the English translation that they have, it's usually set in brackets within the text, and they go, wow, what's that about? They look at the footnote, and it says some manuscripts do not contain those verses. Or they see other footnotes on the text where there's a variant way of saying it. They're not even dealing with spelling errors. They're dealing with genuine variations in the text. And it scares them sometimes, doesn't it?
It does, and it's understandable. I think this actually speaks to the credibility of Christianity in that we're not trying to hide these. Go buy any modern Bible, and I think most of them will have, as you said, set apart in brackets this section in John, the very end of Mark's Gospel, and a couple other places, and then there's that footnote or a note right in the text that says, not every ancient manuscript contains this. There's no dirty laundry here. Christians have long acknowledged this. Going back to the Reformation, going back before that, they talked about these very same variants that we're talking about today. This is not new news, but for the individual who doesn't know it or hasn't heard it before, it can be scary, because I think of what their assumptions are about an inerrant text or an inspired Bible.
So what would those assumptions be that need to be both realized and kind of corrected so that we don't go, like Bart Ehrman admits, went Pollyannishly into New Testament studies and basically robbed himself of the faith?
Right. And Ehrman is a peculiar guy in that I don't know how you can get a degree from Wheaton and a degree from Princeton and not realize that this is what the Bible is like. It has variants. I really think he's trying to scare people. But he himself was a fundamentalist, and I think many Christians who are fundamentalists assume that the text is pristine and has remained that way for 2,000 years. There's no reason to think that. In fact, there's no promise in the text that it will be copied perfectly by all people for all time. Ehrman essentially reasons that if it's not accurately preserved by the copyist, that means that God was never involved in the writing in the first place. And I think a lot of Christians, they're well-meaning, they emphasize the divine authorship of the text, but they do so at the expense of the human authorship and more importantly, for textual criticism, of the human copyists. There's no guarantee that every copy is going to be accurate, and I don't know how there could be such a guarantee. Ehrman kind of acts like God should have come down and physically possessed each person who has ever copied the Bible, and since he didn't do that, obviously there's no God at all, or God wasn't involved in writing the text. But that's just silly.
You used the term textual criticism. What does that mean?
Yeah, we probably should have started there. Textual criticism is the study of copies of manuscripts, any written work, for which the original copies, that is the autographs, are no longer in existence, or they're unknown. A lot of people say that the New Testament autographs, as they're called, the originals, are gone. And they're gone in the sense that we haven't found them. We may find them at some point, but as of right now, we don't have them. So essentially, you try to reconstruct the original text based on the copies.
Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Let's run some numbers, if we could. What are we talking about in terms of manuscripts? Again, no originals, but early copies, later copies, copies of copies. What are we talking about in terms of kind of the fodder by which Bible scholars have been able to put together their best guess, and it's a very good guess at that, as to what the original probably said?
Yeah, good question. The number of manuscripts, now, the New Testament's written in Greek, so we would want Greek, because anything that's not Greek, you know, automatically that's a copy. The number of Greek manuscripts we have is about 5,800 right now. And that ranges from complete copies of the New Testament to, you know, a 3-inch by 5-inch fragment of any of the books. But when you add them all up, there are about 5,800 copies in Greek. And then you add to that all the quotes and allusions from the earliest Christians and all the translations, the early translations into other languages, like Latin, Coptic, Ethiopic, Syriac, and so forth. If you throw all those in, then we have about 25,000 sources on which to base our New Testament. That is phenomenal. And when you just say it, when you just throw those numbers out there and talk about the New Testament, a lot of people don't know what that means. You think 5,800, that's kind of a large number. 25,000, well, that's a larger number. Yes, but when you compare that to other works of antiquity, because textual criticism is done not just for the New Testament, but for any work where you don't have the original. I mean, we don't have Homer's original Iliad. We don't have Plato's original Republic. These all have to be reconstructed through textual criticism. And so when you compare the New Testament with some of these, you find that we stand head and shoulders above any other work from antiquity. For example, I mentioned Homer, the Iliad. For one, we have about 700 copies of it, I think. For Plato, we have about, and we really only have about 10 copies. And yet, if you go ask any ancient historian, or go ask any philosopher, are you bothered by this? Are you bothered that we have so few copies? And they'll say, no, of course not. These are acceptable. So if they're willing to accept these on much less evidence, on far fewer copies, they should certainly accept the New Testament, for which there are thousands and thousands more.
So obviously these things, the number has grown over time. We are talking about ancient copies. We're not talking about some guy decided to sit down with his Novum Testamentum Graecae and just copied out by hand. We're talking about things that were copied, manually copied in the ancient world. How far back do these copies of the originals go, as far as we can tell?
Well, we have, it used to be thought, just until February, it used to be thought that our oldest copy of the New Testament was part of John. It's a pretty famous piece. It's the Rylands Papyrus, P52, dating from about 117 to 125, which is pretty good considering, you know, some people think that John wrote toward the end of the first century. So we're really, you know, one, maybe two generations away from John himself. And there are others about that time. There's part of Matthew at that time, part of Luke, and so forth. So you're really, you know, depending on when you want to date the actual writing of the text, I mean, you're somewhere, you know, 40, 50 years later. But actually, Daniel Wallace, who is one of the leading scholars in the world on textual criticism, I mean, his credentials match Bart Ehrman's easily. And Daniel Wallace actually found about six more ancient Greek papyrus, or papyri, from the 1st and 2nd century. Now, notice I said 1st century. This is actually the earliest copy known. It's from the Gospel of Mark. And people, you know, the paleographers, people whose whole lives are spent looking at these ancient manuscripts, which I'm glad I don't have to do that, but people who are experts in this, they're spending their time right now focusing in on this copy or fragment from the Gospel of Mark, so they can publish the findings next year in 2013, but Daniel Wallace says this is and will be considered the oldest copy of the New Testament in the first century. And this was just found a few months ago, which I think is interesting because that indicates we're going to keep finding and keep finding more and more of these, bringing the time gap down smaller and smaller.
So just real quick before we take that break, are they letting anything out? Are they willing to guess how much earlier in the New Testament? About 10 seconds.
No, they haven't said. But it is interesting because Mark itself, the earliest copy we had before that of Mark was about the year 200. And now we're getting back to the first century.
All right, let's take a break when we come back. Wow, this is good stuff. Mark Pearson is our guest. We're talking about the historical reliability of the New Testament.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe the law condemns everyone and should be preached to the fullest. People who believe the gospel is for everyone and should be preached to its sweetest. Traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice deliver every Sunday this law and gospel, that Christ was crucified for us sinners. To all who received him, who believed in his name, the Gospel of John says, he gave the right to become children of God. To see how Steadfast Lutherans preserves this good news for everyone, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
We have some great programs lined up for you during Holy Week, and here's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen. It's a special church bulletin insert for Issues Etc. Holy Week programming. Just go to the support page at issuesetc.org, download, print, and make copies of the Holy Week bulletin insert. The bulletin insert can be used for the weekend of Palm Sunday, April 1st. Issuesetc.org and click support.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
No gimmicks, no shticks, just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. By the book liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at GraceLutheranRacine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
Often you'll hear an apologist say there are more manuscripts of the New Testament than any other book from the ancient world, therefore we can trust it. Well, what they don't tell you is that, yes, we have these thousands of manuscripts, but no two of them are exactly alike, and that, in fact, the differences in these manuscripts are more numerous than the words of the New Testament. So you have apologists who want to make these claims, but they don't tell you the full story.
That's an excerpt from one of my two interviews with Bart Ehrman. He, of course, is trying to make the argument on the basis of the variants. It's something we're going to be talking about here in the next few minutes as we discuss the historical reliability of the New Testament with Mark Pearson. Mark, let's take up Behrman's argument there. You actually address it directly in your article, Text Typos and Transmission, that, look, we have so many variants in all of – I mean, really only the problem that you laid out before the break I think Ehrman would view it as a problem. Of all these manuscripts, is the more manuscripts we find, the more variants we find. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm glad you picked that clip because Ehrman, that's one of his catchphrases. There are more variants in the New Testament than there are words in the New Testament. I remember when he said that on CNN, Anderson Cooper about fell over himself and got Ehrman to repeat it about 10 times because it sounds like a pretty big deal, but it really isn't. The reason there are so many variants is because there are so many copies. So if you make one copy and there's a single variant in that copy, but then that copy gets copied again and again and again, such that the variant gets copied again and again and again, eventually you're simply going to have more variants than you will have words because of the number of copies. And in my article, the example I use is for the very article I wrote has about 1,000 words in it. If someone were to copy my article and make one mistake, the copy would be 99.9% accurate. And then if there are 2,000 more copies of it, each of them making one mistake, you'd still have a 99.9% accuracy, but then you would have more variants than words. So the real question is not how many variants there are, but how significant the variants are. And it's interesting, though, because Ehrman will say, we pretty much can determine what the New Testament originally said. And there are a couple of gray areas, but he makes those to be a really big deal. The only reason he makes it a big deal is because he knows that he's just blown his whole argument. If you're resting the whole thing on there are so many variants that we can't reconstruct the thing, how then can he say, well, we pretty much know what it said? It's okay. Because he knows it's not about number of variants, but how significant are the variants.
I mean, I just look at, and you know, any pastor worth his salt is doing this on a weekly basis. If he's going to be looking at the New Testament text, he should be looking at them in the original. And in the critical editions of the Greek New Testament, there are footnotes at the bottom. Sometimes they're almost as much as the text. And it's a lot of gobbledygook to the uninitiated. But if you learn to kind of read it, this language of the textual critic, you realize that, you know, for any verse, you're going to find at least, you know, perhaps on average, it's rare to find a verse that doesn't have a variant in it. But what do they consist of, most of them?
Well, most of them consist of spelling mistakes. Many of them consist of different word order, because in Greek you can do that. Some of them consist of, like in Greek, when you have a proper name, and in English this sounds odd, but in Greek you very often have the word the before the name. So like the Peter, or the John, or the Jesus, and sometimes you don't have it. And so in copying these, sometimes the copyist decided to take it out or insert it. But of course that has nothing to do with the meaning of the text. You have lots of these. And so, like, for example, in Greek, there are 16 different ways to say Jesus loves John. 16 different ways to say it. And so the meaning can be the same in 16 different variations of that sentence. In English, it's more difficult because we have a direct object and an indirect object, and we have one word for love, where Greek has four. But anyone who knows Greek will be able to translate that the same way every time and not be at all bothered by the differences in the sentences. 16 different sentences, it means the same thing. If you know Greek, it's not that big a deal. Most pastors know Greek. Most pastors know enough to navigate the textual critical apparatus in their Greek New Testament. The layperson, though, doesn't know this, and that's really why Bart Ehrman is writing bestsellers in biblical studies. Nobody does that. But he does it because he's trying to scare people, and it actually works, which is really sad.
So what you're saying here is that part of the reason there are so many variants is because there are, in fact, so many copies, so many actual early manuscripts, but that most of those variants are inconsequential unless you're a stickler for spelling, and then inconsequential unless you're worried about perhaps the way that the words are ordered, or whether or not words that don't necessarily get translated into English are always included in the text. It sounds like these are honest errors by largely honest copyists.
That's exactly right. And there may have been some instances during some of the Christological heresies where people might have adjusted the text in a dishonest way, but for the most part, those are not even brought into the examination of the earliest manuscripts, because they're later anyway. Most copyists are simply trying as best they can to create an accurate copy. Whether or not they did a good job, we can now determine, and any of these variants are not a big deal. And I say in my article, you could literally take out, you could make a Thomas Jefferson version of your Bible, literally cut out every variant, and your understanding of Jesus would not change. It's not as though one early copy of Mark says that Jesus is the Son of God and was crucified, and another early copy of Mark says he wasn't the Son of God and he never was crucified. We're not dealing with anything like that. We're dealing with exactly what you said, a spelling error or a difference in word order. That does not affect the meaning of the text whatsoever.
But isn't that precisely what Bart Ehrman is kind of banking on? I mean, you've said this several times. He's banking on his readers' ignorance of the real problems. And then he's also banking on the fact that people will infer from what he's saying that the most original, which we don't have, the originals, said something different, like Jesus isn't the Son of God, or he wasn't born of a virgin, or he didn't rise from the dead, and that through these copying errors, somehow it became that he is the Son of God, he did rise from the dead, and he was born of a virgin.
Well, he's entirely banking on it. You go back in time, say a whopping 10 years ago, and you don't have people talking about textual criticism to this degree. I really think that this is kind of just piggybacked on the Da Vinci Code stuff, where it's a conspiracy, and you want to believe in any Jesus except the real one, so you adopt whatever theory you want. And you only read a book by Bart Ehrman, or it's just like people who only read Richard Dawkins. It's like, well, if you're only reading one side of the argument, and you don't even want to hear the other side, of course you're going to accept it. But honest scholars will not do that. And Bart Ehrman is banking on it, but I think that's why we, as the church, especially pastors, need to be proactive here and educate their lay people so that they know what to do when they're confronted with this stuff.
So as someone who studied this, how accurately has the New Testament, from the textual evidence that we have, as ancient as it is, how accurately has it come to us today?
Well, that's a good question, and I mean, I do study this, but not at the level of some people, so I'll defer to Bruce Metzger. Bruce Metzger was actually Bart Ehrman's professor at Princeton, and Bruce Metzger was probably the leading textual critic of the 20th century. He died a few years ago, unfortunately. But he said that there are about 20,000 lines of text in the New Testament. 20,000 lines. Only 40 of those lines could potentially change the meaning of the text. And so when you figure out what's that percentage, it's 0.2% of the entire New Testament has the potential for problems. 0.2%. And yet, not any one of those affects any single point of doctrine. And that's why Bruce Metzger was willing to say, the entire New Testament as a whole has come down preserved to us such that we can reconstruct it accurately to a 99.5% certainty. That is an amazing statistic. And that doesn't come from me. That doesn't come from even one of my seminary professors, as much as I respect them. But this comes from a guy who spent his entire career doing nothing but looking at textual critical issues. And he said, 99.5% accuracy, you can trust the New Testament. Now, for Bart Ehrman, that's not good enough. Bart Ehrman says, if you can't have 100%, you can't have anything. He actually said that in an argument or a debate with Craig Evans, whom I know you've also had on your program. Bart Ehrman said, if you can't prove everything, you can't prove anything. That's a level that no one would require in scholarship. That really does come from Bart Ehrman's former fundamentalist viewpoint, where the whole thing, every letter, needs to be inspired, inerrant, and copied perfectly down to today. Or if I can show you one variant in a modern copy, then the whole thing is tossed out, which is just ridiculous.
Mark Pearson has a Master's of Divinity from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's pursuing a PhD in New Testament Studies. He's written an article for a recent edition of Higher Things magazine titled Text Typos and Transmission, Why You Can Trust the New Testament. Mark, thank you very much for being our guest again.
Thanks, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Pastor Bill Swirla of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California, about the first petition of the Lord's Prayer. That's the first thing we ask for in the Lord's Prayer, significantly, hallowed be thy name. Holy Week is coming up, and we know that you and your congregation will want to be listening during the Holy Week for the special programming that we have here on Issues Etc. That's why right now, at our website, you can go and get our Holy Week bulletin insert. It has many of the programs that will be airing during Holy Week, and a little something to say about the return of Lutheran Public Radio with some Easter programming 24/7 on the internet. For our listeners, another way of saying thank you to all of our listeners, go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support right there at the top of the page, click on the image of the bulletin insert, and you can download it and print it off. Take it to your church secretary or to your pastor, and make sure it gets into your church bulletin this week. It's right there at our website, issuesetc.org, click support at the top of the page. You'll find the Holy Week bulletin insert for Issues Etc. Thanks for doing that for us. Our very best promotion are our listeners and word of mouth. Now, I think we can also say that this accuracy, this tremendous accuracy of transmission can be due to nothing other than God's providential care for this text that he inspired in its original and that he would have all of us read in our translations, so that we might see therein our Savior, Jesus Christ. Talk to you tomorrow.
Weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.